The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Gretchen Rubin. Gretchen is the best-selling author of The Happiness Project, Happier at Home, and her latest book, Better Than Before. She hosts the popular podcast Happier with Gretchen Rubin with her sister Elizabeth, and she holds both an undergraduate and law degree from Yale University, where she was the editor of the Yale Law Journal. She clerked for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Gretchen lives in New York City, and we both have daughters named Eleanor. Gretchen, welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm so happy to be talking to you. And I did not know you had an Eleanor, too. That's great to hear.
My Eleanor is in eighth grade.
Oh, mine's in sixth.
Oh, there we go.
So they're pretty close.
Yeah, pretty close. So I've been listening to your podcast and digging into your writing, and I haven't found any evidence of this, but it seems to me like you're a person who must have taken an improv class because you are like the most natural improviser on paper and in audio that I've ever heard.
Oh my gosh, that's so flattering. No, I have never taken improv, and I was actually just thinking that it would be a great preparation like to do in high school or college, because I feel like that ability to think on your feet is so precious. And I do not feel like I have that, so I'm thrilled to hear that you think so.
Yeah, and the reason I think so is because what I have found as the makeup of sort of great improvisers is they're curious, they're practical, they have a love of systems that's matched by a love of art. So it's very much sort of, you know, system one, system two brain working all at the same time. And you have a lot of that in terms of your writing, in terms of offering very practical advice without losing the poetry.
Oh, well, that's so nice to hear. I would love to think so. Absolutely.
Okay, cool. So one of the things I want to talk about is habits, because Better Than Before talks a lot about habits. And I think as we're digging into understanding improvisation, which is still kind of a baby art form. I mean, in this country, it started really the first improv troupe, professional improv troupe, was 1955. And when you talk about understanding habits, you note that, and I'm quoting you, habits eliminate the need for self-control.
Yes.
Which might appear contrary to some people, but it really isn't, right?
No, and I think you're exactly right that a lot of people, they look at people who have, like, really strong habits, and they think, oh, well, that person has so much self-control, and that's why my habits aren't good, is because I don't have any self-control. I don't have willpower.
Right.
But they did research on looking at people who had really good habits and sort of really good self-command, and what they found is they didn't use much willpower mm-hmm. or self-control, because they turned all this stuff into habits, so they didn't have to make decisions or use willpower in order to get anything done. So they weren't saying to themselves, like, oh, should I go to the gym today? Oh, yeah, I really should, and I'm going to make myself do it. They just were up and at the gym before they even realized what was happening.
Right.
So it's like autopilot.
Totally. And I was in a meeting just today with a bunch of and we do a ton of corporate workshops. That's a big part of our business is businesses bring us in. And we were kicking around why we're successful. And I go, I don't want to burst anyone's balloon, but I think the fact that we make people participate, they don't really have a choice. They can't really flee the room because they'll, lose their jobs. Once they're up and doing, it's all good. But it's because we're actually making them. And they're sort of forced in this condition. But it really is about finding whatever it takes for you to be doing the thing that you ultimately want to do and to be doing it and be practicing it.
No, I think that's such a good point, because I think there's, and I certainly have had this experience myself, where there's sort of a fun of like reading a book about something, like you're reading a book about cleaning clutter, or you're reading a book about mm-hmm. managing your email or whatever it is, and you sort of get like this contact high from it.
Right.
But it's not going to make any difference if you don't do something.
Right.
And so it's like, how do you actually get people, Yeah, it's fine if they're sitting in their seats nodding their heads, but that's not the same thing as actually making somebody do something.
No, and we all know this, too. There's, like, so many people who are, you know, experts in a certain area, and, of course, that's the thing they themselves are terrible at, you know, or the self-help books are just lining the shelf of the person who never goes outside their apartment. Go ahead.
They say that research is me-search, and a lot of people write the books that they kind of need to read. And so you have to always consider the source.
I love that me-search. I'm writing it down. Okay, so one of the things you talk about in Better Than Before, and I think this is real smart, is you have a thing you call the Four Tendencies, which you also refer to as a habit sorting hat for Harry Potter fans. And essentially, these are elements of character, and you identify the four as upholders, questioners, obligers, and rebels. And I was particularly interested in the rebel category because you mentioned that you met a surprising number of clergy who classified themselves as rebels.
Yeah. What the Four Tendencies looks at is how people meet expectations or respond to expectations, whether they outer expectations like work deadlines or inner expectations. Like your own desire to take an improv class.
Right.
And rebels are people who resist expectations, outer and inner alike. Mm-hmm. So they, if you ask or tell them to do something, they're very likely to resist. They don't even like to tell themselves what to do. So it was sort of very surprising that some of them are drawn to areas of high regulation, like the clergy, the military, the police, highly regulated industries. And I've talked to a lot of clergy about it, and it seems like part of it is that you are in this place where you are the connection to God, you know?
Yeah.
Like, there's no one who can tell you what to do because you're hearing, you know, you're channeling it from the highest.
Yep.
And several clergy have sort of pointed out to me that that can often sort of go bad.
Right.
And we've seen examples where that has kind of gone bad.
Sure.
And Thomas Merton, if you know...
I love Thomas Merton, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who that is. Very famous Trappist monk, mm-hmm. like which is highly, highly regimented, controlled kind of monk. He was a classic rebel.
Oh, he's a badass. He was...
Much more than people realize, mm-hmm. yes. He was up to all kinds of mischief.
Yes.
Up there in his little hermit hut.
In Louisville. Locked himself up in a monastery in Louisville, if I am correct. Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And so it's very interesting to think about how a rebel would also be drawn to something like being a Trappist monk. And so, it's a very interesting psychology.
Well,
I'm like the opposite of a rebel. I'm an upholder. And so it's been really fascinating for me to wrap my mind around the way rebels see the world, because until I came up with this framework, I didn't really understand how differently people could see the world from the way that I see the world.
Totally. And the correlation I made is when we found out how many people took improv classes who suffered from social anxiety.
Interesting. Well, that makes perfect sense, though.
For the same reasons you talked about, which is sort of that. Well, it's twofold. One, you think, oh, well, maybe they're forcing themselves into something that's uncomfortable. But in fact, what it was improvisation is such a mindful practice and one in which you can't worry about befores or afters. You have to stay thoroughly in the moment.
Yeah.
And the person across from you, their job is to save you. So, you know, this is like, it was like therapy for so many people.
Isn't that it? And it also gives you skills for, like, how do you handle it?
Yep.
Like, somebody says something, how do you even manage the process of coming up with something to say back? It's all about, okay, how do you keep that going with someone?
Yeah, totally. And the thing that's cool, too, about these sort of, these tendencies and these character relationships as a precursor to habit. So, like, you're putting off habit until you understand this, because the habits change depending on who you are. And I love that, you know, there's not a hierarchy to these, because when I first, you know, encountered these, I think my wife's a huge fan of yours, and she introduced me to your work. And she's like, well, you got to look at these, you know, tendencies. And I'm like, oh, is there, you know, do I have to be, you know, an upholder? Because I'm not.
Right.
And your point is, of course, you don't have to be. You are who you are. And then you're going to pursue your habits accordingly once you know that.
Absolutely. All of the tendencies have big people who have big success and also people who are big losers, and they all have strengths and weaknesses. And so it's just a matter of, like, when you kind of see the pattern for yourself, then you know what you need to do. So let's say someone's an obliger, and they keep saying to their friends, oh, I really want to take improv. I've always been interested in improv. And yet days, months, weeks, years go by, and they're not signing up for that class. Why not? Well, I would say it's because obligers readily meet outer expectations, but they struggle to meet inner expectations. Once they signed up for the class and they had a teacher in a class who was waiting for them, they would have no trouble going. But they might need somebody to say, like, hey, man, you said you were going to sign up for that class. I'm going to sign up, too. Let's go to the same class. Or let's both sign up together. Yeah. Or I'm going to sign up for yoga, and you sign up for improv, so that there's that feeling of outer accountability, because that's what helps obligers. For rebels, they don't like accountability. That can often make them run the other direction. But if you're an obliger, that's the key part that you need.
So my wife says I'm an obliger and a rebel.
Yes, there's a deep affinity between obligers and rebels.
I think so. And the one thing I thought about, the example you just gave, was back in the 90s, when I was producing the Second City show that Tina Fey was in, Tina made me take a class at the Old Town School of Folk Music here, where we learned Elvis Costello's Imperial Bedroom on guitar, the entire album. And it was one of these weird things where it was like, you need to be out of your head and I need to be out of your head, and we're only going to do this if we do it together. So, and that was the case. So we would go to this thing, and I'd drive her off and drop her off in time for the show. And it was definitely one of those, like, oh, I'm so glad I did this, and I never would have, but by the same token, I don't want to be sort of hemmed in. You know, I want to kind of call my own shots.
Well, so here's a pattern that maybe you've experienced, which is obliger rebellion, which is when obligers feel pressure to meet outer expectations. So they will meet expectations, and then suddenly they'll snap, and they'll be like, you know what? I'm done. And I'm not going to do that anymore. And it can be small and symbolic. Like, a surprising number of obligers tell me that they will deliberately be late for work. They will sit in their cars in the parking lot in order to be just a little bit late to work as a form of obliger rebellion. Or it can be huge and destructive. Like, I'm going to quit my job and I'm cleaning out my desk this afternoon. I woke up this morning and I'm ending this marriage. And that's something that happens to obligers if they're not careful. Have you ever experienced that?
Yeah, I don't want to talk about it.
Okay.
anyone who knows me is listening to this going, nah, all right, I can point out a few categories, though I'm still married and very happily so it's not there. But no, I in fact, actually, if I look at my life, I have done major quitting, you know, of things that I stepped down from leading Second City after nearly 30 years last year. Now, in part to do, I'd written this book called Yes And, and I wanted to follow this path, but it was kind of like, I could have had a much more gracious, elegant conversation about it. It was like, woke up one day, I'm like, no, I'm done.
Yeah. So. And so sometimes it can work out fine. And sometimes it can actually be sort of a safety valve for obligers, because if they're in a situation that's just not sustainable, it kind of explodes them out of it. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it can be kind of an important safety net. But it also, a lot of times obligers will look back and sort of, like you're saying, yeah, maybe, like, I could have done that a little bit better, or that could have been less abrupt, or maybe it caused a lot of kind of reputational damage or something. And it feels uncontrolled. I don't know about you, but often the metaphors people use is volcanoes exploding, balloons bursting, pots with the lid being, exploding off. It's a feeling of, like, explosive relief, not kind of a managed exit.
Yep, that's it.
Yeah, so most people know what they are just from hearing a little conversation, but I will say that if anybody wants to take a quiz, they can go to happiercast.com/quiz, and you can take a very short quiz that will actually, like, say, are you an upholder, a questioner, an obliger, or a rebel?
I know someone who I had coffee with this morning who just finished the quiz, or was about to finish the quiz.
And what do you know what tendency they were?
No, because she didn't finish. She, like, started it, and then she was going off to it, so I'll find out. You know, there's one thing I actually wanted to ask you about, was when you talk about monitoring. Mm-hmm. There's the quote from the book where you say, the strategy of monitoring has an uncanny power. It doesn't require change, but it often leads to change.
Mm-hmm.
How does that tell us what you're talking about when you talk about monitoring?
So monitoring is just paying attention to how much you're actually doing something, because as you might expect, we're often not that good. Like, if you say to people, how far do you think you walk in a day? They really have a very a lot bigger view of how far they're walking. And if you say to somebody, how much do you think you eat in a day? They will underestimate how much do you spend in a day? And so monitoring is just, literally monitoring how much you're doing of something. And that could be, how many times in a week do you read a bedtime story to your child? Or, because maybe you're doing better than you think, maybe you're doing worse than you think. Just monitor it. How many times do you lose your temper with your coworkers? How many times are you eating out or ordering in food during the course of a month rather than cooking at home? What research shows is that just by monitoring, people start to change they start to drift towards better behavior. That just knowing what you're doing increases people's self-awareness and they start behaving better. And so it's a really good thing to do just generally. And then it also makes it a lot easier when you are trying to change because you have a sense of what's my baseline? What would it look like if I really increase this behavior? And another thing a lot of people like to do, which is kind of an aspect of monitoring, is the don't break the chain. Hmm. People get really into not missing a day. Now, some behaviors you kind of can't do that. But there's some things where you can really pretty much do it every day, and that's a form of monitoring that people get really into.
Well, there's a couple things about this that are very interesting to me. And I was just reading Nicholas Epley's book, MindWise, who's a behavioral scientist at the University of Chicago. And he specifically talks about the fact that, we're actually pretty terrible as human beings in terms of perspective. And we radically underestimate or overestimate stuff. We're way off. And that first was wake up call. And then the second part of that is the change part. And I noted this today in that same meeting I was in. We talked about one of the first things when we teach writing in our training center is we say to people who want to be writers, you know what? If you simply write a page or two every day, mm-hmm. you're going to be ahead of 99% of the people in the world who call themselves writers.
Yeah.
Because people just don't do it. And so there's actually a very freeing aspect once you get past the fact that you've been wrong for so long.
Yeah, no, it is, and the more you do something, then the less of a big deal it seems like. If you write once a week, you feel like, oh my gosh, here I am, this is my writing session, I gotta be productive, my stuff's gotta be good, I get freaked out, if this is the one time, maybe I have to do it all day long, or 5 hours. Mm-hmm. But if you're doing it every day, no one day has to be that good.
Nope. Nope.
It's I brush my teeth every day. Sometimes I just went to the dentist, and it turns out I have not been brushing my teeth long enough. I got a little lecture from the dentist.
Yep.
But it does, you brush your teeth every day. One day is too long, a little bit longer. One day is a little bit shorter. It's not a big deal. And so when you do something every day, it demystifies it, and it's part of the ordinary routine. It doesn't feel like this extra burden on your day. So I got to get geared up for it, and I'm going to dread it, and then I'm going to reward myself for it. It's just, what do you do every day? Oh, every day I write a page.
Yeah.
It's just the way things are. It's not a big deal.
Yeah.
It's just daily life.
Yeah, and again, what's interesting about this is it's not just one thing. It's the two things. So that, I think very much we build up a wall for ourselves because these things look so hard. I've got to change everything in my life. And that ain't true. But the reverse isn't true either. And I was reading, because I'm a total nerd, this paper called Habitual Creativity. It was published by the London School of Economics. And it the quote from there that I pulled was, improvisational freedom is only possible against a well-defined backdrop of rules and roles. Spontaneity must be anchored in habitual patterns of behavior. And I think that's what we're talking about, which is you do want to feel free to improvise. You are never going to be a free-flowing improviser if it's not grounded in the practice.
That's such an interesting way to put it. Yes, yes, yeah.
So
yeah, and I think for most people, rebels are a little different in the way that they think about habits, but also many rebels want habit-like behaviors, is that most of the things that we want really require a habit of it, like eating healthily, mm-hmm. being productive, exercising, getting enough sleep, seeing your friends, even something like, I want to leave my day job and switch careers. Well, that's going to take a lot of consistent progress. You can't sit down and bang that out in a weekend.
Right.
And so for almost anything that we want to do, it takes a lot of building up. Mm-hmm. And habits are a way to do it. And then once you have that base, like you say, that's when you can decide how you're going to riff off of it.
Yep, yep. You're a declutterer, right? You like to organize like drawers and stuff?
I do.
All right, so how's that play out with your kids? Do you have to fight? Like, do you not go in the room? Do you I mean, because I like it is a horror story in my children's rooms that I can't take. It is like I turn OCD in the worst possible way. How do you handle that, the fact that, you know, there's entropy and chaos going on in your home?
Well, I know that's one of the things that has struck me most is the degree to which, for most people, outer order contributes to inner calm and inner self-command. Like you and like you and me, it just, we want things to be in their places.
Yep.
And it's, so my tendency is upholder, and one of the things that is tends to be true of upholders is they don't like to tell other people what to do.
Ah.
They want people to tell themselves what to do, which is an even higher bar, it turns out. So I'm like, I don't want to tell my kids to make their beds. I want them to just make their beds on their own because they want to make their beds, which is even more impossible.
I know. I was going to say, how's that working out for you?
No. So basically, I figure if I want to clean it up, I clean. If I want to clean, I clean it up.
Okay.
And if I don't care, then I just let them have it the way they want to have it. I'm fortunate that one of them is pretty tidy. She's an abundance lover. I talk about simplicity lovers and abundance lovers.
Yeah.
Simplicity lovers like clean surfaces and bare, you know, bare desks and few things. She's an abundance lover. She's got stuff on every. It's all beautifully arranged. She knows exactly where everything is. But to me, it's like overwhelming stimulus, but that's how she wants it.
Right.
And my other one is pretty messy, but not horribly messy, and she's very patient with me going in there and like rounding up the nail polish bottles and putting them in the drawer. So if I feel so moved, she doesn't object. I don't know. Maybe, your kids might be the kind that like don't want you messing with their stuff, so they want it messy and they want you to stay out of it too.
Well, yeah. So I have one who's they're both, right. So, and my kids are a little bit older than yours. So we just dropped off Nick at college. He's a freshman.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
Oh,
so,
wow.
but here's kind of a cool thing that happened, and it's by accident, which is somehow my son's iPhone and my daughter's phone, the calendar is hooked up. So she's getting his calendar. But here's what he's doing. He's using his calendar at college. And she goes, oh, Nick's got a bullshit costume meeting at 10, which is how he put it in. And so, because he's in some sort of theatrical production.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Oh,
but
my gosh.
So this kid who would never, like, I would get him notebooks and calendars and, like, he eschewed all of it, has sort of realized freshman year of college. He's like, no, I've got to now put all this stuff in my calendar. And he's doing it every single day because it's still coming through Nora's iPhone.
Well, see, here's a really interesting point that that I think is true, and that's a perfect illustration. Is I think a lot of times, adults and parents, we think like it's our job to totally shape these children, and like, and so many people have said to me like, oh, my kid is so messy, and I just think they're going to go off to college, and they're going to be like the horrible messy roommate that nobody can stand, and show us no consideration for other people. And my view is exactly that way. Your kid can get off to college and become a neat freak because they're their own people much more than they might be reacting to our habits, kind of under our roof, but. I feel like, you know, to a very great degree, people are who they are, and it's not so easy to mold the clay. And so here, you know, your son, he, like, figured, you know, it's college. I got to get it together. I don't want to remember all this stuff. I'll just put it in my phone. And everybody around him probably is putting it in their phone.
Yep.
If you're standing there and 20 people who are going to be at the costume meeting are busily putting it in, you're like, okay, I guess that's what we freshmen do when we have to go to a meeting, and... You get it.
Yeah, and this is the thing about having children for me, because it is kind of a science experiment that you're, you know, and it really is, because
non-replicable, high-stakes science experiment. Yeah,
you've been, you know, they allow. I remember this vividly, going home in the car with Nick when he was a baby, going, I cannot believe they're allowing us to leave with this human being, and the rest of life works out a little bit like that. But one of the things that you're surprised that they change, you know, and you get surprised by this, and the way that correlates to a lot of sort of adult learning, I think, is important, because I think we forget that we can change, and we do, and especially as I turn 50 this year, and what a huge, you know, sort of change in terms of my attitude towards, you know, purpose and care and relationships and you know, really trying to be a less isolated human being, because I'm realizing that more and more what brings me, you know, joy is being part of a community. And that doesn't mean I can't sit at home and quietly read a book, but it also means that I'm going to go share what I read with my friends and talk about it and, you know, put myself out there. And one of the things I love in The Happiness Project, which is such a great book, you charted out 12 commandments, and many of them are all along the lines of things that you would expect, like, you know, let it go or enjoy the process. But your first commandment was be Gretchen.
Yeah, everybody has to substitute their own name if they want to use that.
I'm assuming people got that. You don't want to say be Gretchen. Yeah. This is not like an ego trip. But what does that mean for you? What did that mean for you in the context of those commandments?
Well, you know, and the more that I sort of study human nature, the more true that I think that that is, for habits, for happiness, anything. And it's not new advice, because, by the way, it is engraved on the Temple of Apollo at Delphi. So know thyself is something that goes way, way back.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, we can only build a happy life on the foundation of our own interests, our own values, our own temperament, our own nature. And I feel like the more I know myself, the more I can make decisions that are going to take me closer to what I really want my life to be. Because it's so easy for us to get distracted by the way we wish we were, or the way other people want us to be, or the what we think we ought to be. And so, you know, you'd think it'd be so obvious to know yourself, because you just hang out with yourself all day long.
Mm-hmm.
But I really think it's like the great project of our life is to know ourselves.
Right. And then that, you know, that extends to you know, relationships. And you know, for February, you're in the book, you talk about Remember Love.
Yeah.
One of our most recent podcasts was with the Dr. Reverend Samuel Wells, who is the vicar of St. Martin in the Field. In London, and kind of I discovered him because he wrote a book on Christian ethics and improvisation.
Mm.
And as I started to dig in, he one of his sermons was about marriage, and I love this phrase. He said, for him, marriage is a constancy that runs through mistakes, misunderstandings, and failures.
Yeah,
which I just think is beautiful, because it's and he goes, and really the best stuff is the way we pivot and change and relate in relation to those things. And by extension, he goes, I kind of think that's what humankind is too. And when you talk in Remember Love, you talk about things like, you know, anti-nagging techniques and mm-hmm. fighting right. And this is all stuff that's like, you're not being Pollyannic. You're admitting that this is messy and mucky, but you're with this other person. And if you can make these nudges and these adjustments around stuff that's kind of hard, there's a lot of joy to be found there.
There is, and I really feel like it's, you know, this is not anything that people haven't thought of. I think that people know all this stuff. It's just that we have to be reminded. And one of the things that has been so helpful to me in my own life, having written like The Happiness Project and Better Than Before, is that just when you kind of force yourself to articulate a thought in your own mind, or when you're like, when my husband does this thing that's super annoying to me, I will choose to do this other thing. Just sort of pre-planning it, or mm-hmm. thinking about the way you want to behave, the way what you want to expect from yourself, really helps in the moment to make the better choice. I have literally stood there with my mouth hanging open, being like, okay, I have a choice to make here. I can take this to 11 and go operatic, or I can laugh it off,
mm-hmm.
you know, spilled milk, nothing to do about this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there I am trying to, you know, make a decision. And I think the more you think about, well, what kind of choice is really going to make me happier in the long run, then the easier it is to make the choice
right. That's
going to make you happier in the long run. Because a lot of times, it takes a little self-command.
Totally. But what you've done, though, is you've given yourself choices and options. And so, like, in the anti-nagging thing, one of the things I loved is your one-word reminder.
Yes.
That's awesome, because that is one of the, and my wife and I do that with each other, which is like door, you know, lights, like you never turn off the lights, but I'm just going to say
yapping,
lights.
Yapping. Yeah. And we do a thing too where it's like we have a signal, so there's not even any word change. Like, it's easier for me to get prescriptions filled. So my husband just leaves a prescription bottle upside down on the bathroom counter, and that just means, honey, would you please get my prescription filled? And then I do, you know, it's like, and then nobody has to say anything.
Nope. I love it.
And, because nagging, part of nagging, it doesn't work. And by the way, speaking of tendencies, if you are with a rebel,
mm-hmm.
nagging actually makes things worse. You are slowing things down. And over people will be like, well, I kept reminding him to do blah, blah, blah. And I tried to help, and I wrote a sign. And I'm like, you know why it took so long? because you kept telling them what to do.
Totally.
If you tell them what to do, they have to resist. If you had said nothing, they probably would have decided within a week that they wanted to do this task and get it over with, because they could do whatever they want to do.
Yep.
So
yep.
It's nagging is ineffective and often counterproductive.
Right. And so what you do is you come up with all these different little sort of methods, and sometimes they're little sort of hidden psychology experiments. And, you know, one of the things that happens in theater is when it's 5 minutes before showtime, the stage manager comes through and says 5 minutes, and everyone has to say to him, thank you, five. And that is a acknowledgement that you've heard, and you know that you're at going to be at places in 5 minutes. And my wife and I, very early with our kids, used this for, we're signaling the end of bath time. We're signaling when you need to turn out the lights, and we would make them say, you know, we'd be like, okay, five, you know, thank you, five. And it is like, it worked like a charm.
That is so brilliant. I have never heard this. This is so fascinating to me. So yeah. It's kind of like, so somebody can't be like, well, they never told me, or
right.
I didn't hear. It's
exactly.
Like, it's
no, you, I, we both acknowledge you said it verbally and probably looked at me in the same way that the flight attendant does that, you know,
yeah.
in the exit row.
But see, and I'm a big believer in the power of ritual.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's something very calming and centering. Like, I remember when I was in high school, they had this whole ritual, which I didn't appreciate that it was unusual at the time, which was when you took an exam, like, they passed it out in this very ritualistic way, and then everybody would wait with it closed until, like, it was exactly time, and then they would say, it is mm-hmm. now 12 o'clock. You have 2 hours to complete this exam. And it was just sort of this incantation.
Yeah.
And when I got to college, it was just like, everybody just run out to the stop, grab it, run back. It was mm-hmm. just chaos. And I hated it because I thought, it's so nice to have that kind of centering ritual at the beginning. And you're right, with kids, they need transitions. We need transitions. I mm-hmm. mean, you should say that to your wife.
Mm-hmm.
You know, dinner reservations in five, you know, because
yeah.
it's helpful.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, no, it's pretty cool. And I love thinking about the fact that you wanted all your educational experiences to be like the paper chase. So, like,
yes.
you know,
love that.
Yeah. One of the things in your Secrets of Adulthood, you have this sort of, it's a great list, and everyone loves lists, and I love this one. And I'm going to pick two of your secrets that I think together explain the universe.
Oh, ooh, gosh.
So here's what they are.
Take notes. Okay, yeah.
No, you already have it, but you just need these two. One is, people don't notice your mistakes as much as you think.
Yes.
And the other is, bring a sweater. Leave it at that. It covers everything.
Yes.
You could have just put that inside the book, and then it would have been done, and it would have been very quick for you, and there wouldn't have been much paper to, you know, waste. I love it.
Is hilarious.
Yeah.
Yes.
Source code for life.
Source code for life. Absolutely.
So we don't have much time left because we try to keep these to 30 minutes. And one of the things I'm going to ask you in a second is to tell me a yes and story sometime in your life where, you know, you should have said no. But before that, you worked for Justice O'Connor.
I did.
All right. So I'm curious, and we don't have to get political here, but in an environment where, like, literal life and death decisions are being made, you know, how does one tend to their happiness? And you may not have been thinking this at the time, but I'm just curious now, looking back, is what was the spirit, or you know, was there a culture of levity? Were people happy? Was it serious all the time? What was life like when you were in that position?
I'll tell you the thing about the Supreme Court, which is that you may fervently disagree with the justice and think that they are completely wrongheaded, but every member of the Supreme Court is absolutely dedicated to doing the right thing. And they want to, they have a vision for what it means to be the United States and how decisions should be made, and they are committed to doing their best and to trying to be fair. And so it was very, there was a kind of a transcendent quality to it, because everybody there was really good at their jobs. Like, all my fellow clerks were, like, insanely brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was just this feeling of people doing very important work at a very high level and taking it very seriously. And there's something really satisfying about that, because I feel like in the world, often stuff is done 65%, 80%. You're like, this could be better, but who's got the time? Oh, this doesn't really matter. Let's just blow this off. Oh, yeah, that person probably should get fired, but who, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like, everybody was, you know, and even if you disagreed with them, they were doing what they believed to be the right thing. And, you know, So in that way, it was a very interesting place to work, and it was a very kind of it was a patriotic place to work. And oh my gosh, speaking of ritual openings, when they would do that thing for, you know, all people having business before this, the Supreme Court of the United States, it was just, you know, gave me goosebumps every time.
Yeah, competency is a thing. I was reading this study that just came out of Harvard about status and humor, and what the study proved was that people who use humor immediately attract a level of status, but when it's inappropriate humor, the response is that you lose the appearance of competency. But the successful use of humor, you get the double barrel. You are seen as high status, effective, and competent.
Yeah, because it's a way to, like, it brings people together. It creates teams.
Yeah.
It dissolves antagonisms. I mean, people who can do it, my husband is great at this. He can be critical of somebody in a funny way so that it really takes the sting out of it.
Right.
So that somebody's like, okay, I hear you, man. And it's like message delivered, but in a way that the person doesn't feel belittled by it. And that is a really, really hard skill.
Yep.
To use humor, like, to diffuse tension.
Yep.
It's so powerful, but it is a skill. I mean, people respect it because they're like, you've got to be on the top of your game to pull that hat out of, you know, pull that tool out of your bag.
Well, and I think right now, it's our refuge in a very upsetting political moment, which is why we're attracted to Samantha Bee and John Oliver and Stephen Colbert and Seth Meyers and all these thinkers who can digest things for us in a way to kind of, you know, the elephants in the room, but they're also, you know, they're bursting the bubble for us because it's hard. It's sort of hard to watch all of this, right? It's very painful stuff and upsetting stuff and strange and surreal stuff. And you know, comedians have become kind of our truth tellers.
And it's a way to get information in a way that's interesting and captivating and memorable.
But
can also be very actually full of facts and analysis, you know.
Yeah,
again,
yeah.
If people are at the top of their game, they can synthesize things in that way.
Right.
Because it's one thing to give a bunch of facts. It's another thing to give a bunch of facts that gives people a point of view and that they can remember later.
Right. And then to the point of this paper, you have to do it with mastery, because if you don't, that's and we all know that's the person who says the wrong thing on Twitter.
Yeah.
You know, suddenly you're done.
Yeah.
It's all over. All right. So I can't imagine. I feel like you're a person who doesn't say no a lot. You probably have a lot of sort of yes and in you. But I'm curious, along your path in your life, was there ever a moment where it was sort of like, oh no, I would normally say no and I didn't, or the reverse, where you really realized that something should have been a no as opposed to a yes and?
Oh, well, see, I think that's a great corollary, because sometimes I think the problem is, you know, it's not always that the yes is right. Sometimes you can say yes to something, saying yes to when you should say no. But I would say, for me, I mean, back to me being a clerk, it was a fantastic experience to be a lawyer, and I know I don't regret it at all. But there was a time where I began to think, you know what, I don't really think that I want to be a lawyer. And I began to, you know, and I was working on a book in my free time without even really knowing it was a book. And I started thinking, well, you know, I'm doing this as a hobby, but some people do this for a living. And I started thinking, wow, should I really try to become a lawyer? I mean, become a writer. Could I leave behind all my legal experience and credentials and everything? And I was like, yeah, because at this point, I'd rather fail as a writer than succeed as a lawyer.
Wow.
So I better, like, well, I'll give it my shot.
And who'd you affect with that decision? Were you married then?
I was married, yeah.
Yep, so there's one.
You know, my parents, who helped me to go to college and law school.
Yes, right. That's a big one.
Which had just ended 2 years before. And then I was like, hey, you know what? I think I'm going to just throw that all away and start over from zero. And by the way, I had nothing. I had not written a short story. I had not worked on a newspaper or a magazine. I had no clips.
Wow.
I was like, I had been an English major. That was like as close as I came to having anything, you know, in terms of evidence that I could do it.
And did they yes and you? I mean, what was there? Or was that like, was there a lot of no that had to get to yes?
No, you know what? Now that I'm a parent, I respect this even more than I did at the time. My parents and my husband were absolutely tolerant of risk. They were like, if this is what you want to do, that's great. They did not, because I think I would have been very influenced if they had really had really counseled me not to. And my father said something that to me was very reassuring, and I've told people this, and a lot of them are like, that sounds really undermining. But I'm like, no, it was actually the right thing to say. My father said, well, you know what, darling, you might not knock it out of the park right away, but you will get there. And to me, that was really helpful because it was like, you don't have to decide whether you're a success in the first year or two.
Right.
This is a long, if you want this to be the long game, you got a lot of time and you'll get there. And that was very reassuring to me because I think sometimes when you make a big change, you're like, well, if, to justify all this upheaval, I got to like make a big splash. Mm-hmm. Well, you know. You don't always make a big splash.
Nope. But you did.
But, you know, people feel like, oh, The Happiness Project was your first book. No, it was my fourth book.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's the whole overnight, 10 years to being an overnight sensation.
Oh, I always tell, you know, when Steve Carell was in the Second City system for a decade, and no one who came to the shows was leaving going like, I just saw Steve Carell, or even, they lie about it now that they came to shows, and they'll give the wrong years, and I'm like, You didn't recognize the brilliance in front of you. We kind of all knew because we were with him all the time, but his overnight success was, you know, about 25 years. So that happens. And Colbert, too. I mean, Colbert at one point was, like, doing work on Good Morning America, trying to be, like, a weird Willie Geist. Like, it didn't fit, and it wasn't right for him. And then found himself with Steve at The Daily Show, and then the world changed. But that took a while.
Yeah, no, Ira Glass has this great thing about how when you're starting out, it's so hard because you have this vision in your head of what you want to achieve, and like, but what you're actually doing is so bad that you just feel this despair because, like, I had the standards, and I'm fairly short of my own standards. And he's like, it just takes a while to get good enough to be able to, you know, live up to your standards of what you want to achieve. You can't necessarily do that right away.
Yeah, totally. Gretchen Rubin, you can find all her stuff at GretchenRubin.com. You totally got the podcast with her sister is great. It's like listening in to, you know, two very cool people. But the books are great, and there's a lot. It's updated constantly. I highly recommend that everyone go to it. Gretchen, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was so much fun to talk to you. I so appreciate the opportunity.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine.